This episode features depictions of violence, death, and language that some listeners may find offensive, as well as discussions of suicide, murder. Listener's discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. Does being treated unfair or just feeling threatened by the presence of dominant race justify the act of slaughter and cold murder? Does violence ever solve anything? Let's see how serial killer Craig Chandler Price, A Tale of Rage and Senselessness, end. Hello to all the insomniacs and all those people who just tune in to fall asleep or are driving to small or time-consuming destination, and hello to rest of my victims whom I may have literally, forcibly pushed to listen, and welcome to my dear new listeners who may have stumbled upon accidentally and clicked on my podcast. You are listening to Crime with Kay. Rebecca Becky Splitzer was a 27-year-old divorcee with two children living at 60 Innes Rick Road Island in 1987. She lived at residence for close to a year with her brother Carl, but her lease was ending. As she's done many times before, Becky packed the majority of her furniture. Carl stopped the newspaper delivery and piled what little bed was left into cardboard boxes. She was set to move by July 31st. She moved only twice before in her life, when her mother remarried and when she divorced her husband, Stephen. Still, there was something like a rhythm one gets into. On July 27th, Becky's rhythm involved running errands. Her children, Stephen Jr. 8 and Daniel 4, were with their father for the day. As Becky and a friend continued to pack the house that afternoon, they withdrew $80 from Fleet Bank to pay for storage. Hours later, Becky cooks a chicken dinner for her friend, and brother Carl. Carl soon heads to work for an all-night security guard shift, and around 9 p.m., the boyfriend at Becky's friend makes an appearance and helps the woman pack up a few more things. They take a break around 9:30 for ice cream, but instead driving around for 2 hours getting cigarettes, ice cream, hot dogs, fries, and pick stop at boyfriend's to see his dog. Exhausted from her adventures, Becky gets home and changed into a lilac nightgown and settles under her blanket on the living room floor, the TV blaring VH1 music videos. Her visitors left her around midnight. If only they would stay. Carl Betty returned home from work to find his sister lying in a pool of blood. I don't remember what happened, he said in the interview. Sometime later, I'd call 911, and I know I'd try to revive her. Becky Spencer had been brutally stabbed 58 times. The knife had punctured her heart, lungs, liver, face, and head. It was frustrating because you didn't know what happened. You know what was going on. We were getting very little for the police departments at the time, he said. We thought it would end up an unsolved mystery. And for 2 years, the violent murder of Becky Spencer remained unsolved. Then it happened again. Little is known about the marriage of Sergeant John J. Heaton and Joanne Heaton, but it can be assumed as a happy one together. They had two daughters, Jennifer and Melissa Heaton, but no matter how much sometimes someone smiles and laughs, there could be a demon they are fighting, and for John, it became too much to bear, and on June 29th, 1983, he took his own life. 2 years later, Joanne and her daughters moved into Buttonwood section of Warwick, and for 4 years the family lived peacefully. But on September 3, 1989, their peace would unfortunately end. On September 4th, Joanne's mother, Mary, and sister Mary Lou to the welfare community checked after not seeing or hearing from trio Labor Day weekend. Strangely, no one answered the door, so the two found their way inside. There was blood-splattered walls led to the discovery of Joanne, Jennifer, and Melissa. 39-year-old Joanne was underneath the blood-soaked sheets in the hallway. She had 11 stab wounds to chest, face, neck, and rib, totaling 57. She had skull fractures and numerous injuries from blunt trauma and was also strangled. Jennifer, 10, was lying nearby. She had been stabbed 62 times and had skull fracture. Youngest daughter, Melissa, 8, was on kitchen floor with 7 stab wounds and a bashed skull. Melissa's murder was so aggressive that pieces of knives broke off in her neck. Mary Lou immediately called 911. Retired Warwick Police Detective Kenneth Anderson stated the bodies had been covered with blankets, maybe 2 blankets and a rug underneath. The blankets were these 3 bodies that were absolutely destroyed. The perpetrator that day to us was unbelievable. It was believed they died 3 days prior to discovery. Expert blood analysis, Dr. Henry Lee analyzed the blood at the scene, finding a bloody sock imprint. Whoever left the imprint wore a size 13 shoe, he said. FBI profiler Greg McCartney suggested that with the frantic manner of stabbing that the killer possibly injured his hand, it was important to look for someone with a cut or bandaged head in the neighborhood. Carl Betty said upon learning about the murder that he knew it was the same killer that murdered his sister. The similarities between 2 crimes were striking. Both the cases involved a weapon already present in the house. There was an unusual display of overkill and the murders were close in proximity. Detectives Ray Pendergast and Mark Pendleton drove through a park near Buttonwoods, recognizing 15-year-old Craig Chandler Price. Pendergast was his basketball coach. He lived only a few houses down from the Heatings. The 3 engaged in conversations, but the detectives couldn't help but noticed the bandage on his hand. They inquired how he hurt himself, to which Price said he got drunk nights earlier and punched his hand through a car window on Keeley Avenue. Intrigued, detectives followed up on this. There was not a police report of a broken car window and found no evidence on Keeley Avenue to suggest it. They dug further. They went to Craig's home and asked for him and his parents to come to the station. From there, they asked again about his hand, but Craig stuck to his story. Unconvinced, investigators asked him to take a lie detector test. The polygraph concluded he was lying, but that didn't prove he was a murderer. Further interviews with Craig's friends and acquaintances revealed that he ran with gangs that were known to burglarize. Even more, they discovered Craig was boasting about killing Becky Spencer. They then obtained a search warrant. On September 17th, the detectives Kevin Collins, an Arthur Anderson, and Tim Colgan entered the Price house and began to search through the ranch-style home. Greg was unfazed, allegedly falling asleep as detectives went through the search. They woke him up after finding a trash bag in the shed behind the house containing several bloody knives along with bloody clothing, one of which mentioned the bloody sock print found at the crime scene. Gloves and other objects were also spotted. 2 weeks of the heat on murders, Greg Price was arrested and charged for their murders. Now in custody, detectives want to hear his side of tale, and so it began. Greg Chandler Price was third child born to John and Shirley Price in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Shirley was a clerical worker and Kmart employee, while John was a manager at Pepsi. They moved in 1987 when Greg was 5276 Ines Avenue, and besides a few accident-prone events, Craig was a normal child. He loved football and baseball and playing his electric guitar. He loved to crack jokes and tell stories and was quick to offer assistance to his neighbors. But there was a pain building inside him. To the best of his recollection, Craig was 9 or 10 years when he wished someone would die. He was racing his new bike against a few other Buttonwood kids when he hears someone yell, "Hey, spear chucker!" Greg tried to ignore him, but a golf ball was thrown towards him and he was forced to see who did it. The kid was maybe 19, straggly hair, and had two friends with him. The kid asked, "Did you steal that bike, you N-word?" Greg didn't respond, out of fear, which caused the boys threw more golf balls and racial slurs. They got into their cars. As the kids got into their bikes, the car pulled up alongside him and the straggly haired teen screamed more racial slurs. "I just went to a panic and I tried to literally outrun this car. I really thought these bleeps want to kill me," Craig later remarked. He then pleaded into a curb and dumped the bike, which resulted in a mangled chain, guard-tilted seats, and bent handlers. Craig was angry for not standing up for himself, and that anger began to fester. By the time he was 15, he obtained a record including breaking, entering the theft, peeping into houses and using drugs, but he traces the route of his emotional deviance to racism in a 13-page paper by Alan B. Feinstein. Craig recalls to him how he was served soda in a paper cup while the other kids had glasses, or how young children wonder where he was, alluding to the possibility of harm interviews conducted with the CP candidate, that his victims were not chosen at random or as a matter of convenience, but rather due to their being associated with some preserved racial slight directed towards him. Allen wrote the possibility exists that CP possessed a pre-existing paranoid trait which didn't cause him to perceive mistreatment that was non-existent upon his initial arrest. Craig confessed to the heat and murder and unsolved murder of Rebecca Spencer. He explained that he and the neighborhood kids were playing manhunt and hide-and-seek game with teens. Greg was the hunter, The game took up most of the neighborhood yards and driveways. At around 9 p.m., he escorted two kids to a utility pole that acted as the jail, and when a white car came down the street, interrupting the game. In the police statement, the kids would say that the man driving yelled at them for being in the street and they would get run over next time. Craig stated that the driver honks his horn, rolled down his window and called him a racial slur. Craig also stated that he'd seen the man at Becky's house about a week earlier. Carl Betty, Becky's brother, but eventually told police he noticed a bunch of kids playing in front of his house when he pulled up, but never said what he said to them. I was completely outraged by this guy almost hitting us with a stupid car, outraged by this bleep calling me a spook, and I was unyielding outraged in my own self. We were just standing there and not saying or doing anything, Craig said. I simply could not banish from my mind the fact that I not only wanted to kill but had to kill. So on the night July 27th, my mind was made up to murder. John Price had already left for the night shift. Craig's older sister, Kimberly, was staying with friends and his mother and brother were asleep. He carried a Black Magic aluminium baseball bat as he crept outside and ducked in the shadow towards the house, two doors down. With every fiber of being, I wanted nothing more than to kill, Craig said. But the ones he wanted to kill weren't around. The white car was gone. He went home and angrily got high, deciding that if he couldn't kill anyone, he just would vandalize the house instead. He left the bat behind and went back through the shadow towards the Spencer's home, peering inside. All he could see was light from a TV and cardboard boxes. Closing in on the dining room window, he could barely make out the head of someone under a blanket on the carpet while he glared. Inside that, cats startled him. He stomped his foot and cats scattered through the open door at the back of the house. Following the cat, Craig went through the kitchen. Upon seeing Becky sleeping, different ideas went through his mind. He thought about robbing the house and burning it down, but didn't have any matches. Then he considered rigging the wire to start a fire and throw a cinder block through the window. He picked up a frying pan, deciding on a weapon, but it wasn't good enough. He found a 10-inch carving knife and walked into the next room and stood over Becky. Silence blended back into my mind. I listened, transfixed by the silence, and let the parade of memories march away into the darkness. I can remember being drawn into throbbing blue light the television was giving off. A strange sense of awareness settled upon me, and with this awareness came this raw and savage sense of outrage that completely consumed me. It was time to kill. After the murder, Craig went out the house, flung the knife and ran home, he thought for a second, and ran back to his Spencer's to get the frying pan and then shucked it before coming out to his backyard. He entered his room and removed his bloody clothes, stuffing them into a bag and hiding them in the attic. He tiptoed downstairs to the bathroom and washed off the blood. He relaxed with a pipe and drifted to sleep. Days turned to weeks, which became 2 years, and investigators still hadn't found Becky Spencer's killer. I truly felt like getting away with it. It was my fate and destiny. I really felt clever and supreme. I acted just like everybody else who thought a killer walked their neighborhood streets. Craig Price had committed his first murder at the age of 13. Craig's retelling of the murders of the Heatons was a bit different. I started the same way as Becky's, with alleged racial tension. According to Craig, 2 weeks prior to the deaths, he met the family for the first time on a bike ride. He offered to fix a chain that slipped off one of the girls' bikes. As he fixed it, he claims he sensed an aura of racial bigotry from them. A few days afterwards, he says he knows Joanne eyeing him from her window. As he walked home, he concluded that he had to kill her. I knew the act of killing Joanne Heaton was the answer. He slipped on gloves and slipped out of his shoes and either cut the window or simply climbed inside, accidentally landing on the table and breaking it. The noise had woken Joanne, who walked into the kitchen and saw Greg. When she turned on the light in a panic, he claims he grabbed Joanne, then bit and strangled her. Her screams woke up her daughters, who came to see what was going on. Panic gave way to anger, and anger gave way to blinding fury. Some people say it, but I have actually seen it. I could actually see the color red cloud my vision, and the rage I felt was like a wave of heat. They kept crashing on me and popping my ears, Craig later said. Melissa ran to the kitchen to call police, but Craig overtook her. He tackled him to the floor, went to the kitchen and grabbed some knives and began to stab them all during the attack. One of the girls bit Craig's hand, so he bit her back on the face and then bit Joanne. He then grabbed a stool and smashed it over Melissa's head. He says he didn't expect them to put up as big of a fight as they did during the murders. He accidentally stabbed his hand. He removed his glove and tended to his injuries in the bathroom, not knowing he left a trail of blood and sock print. Once clean, he covered the family's bodies with blankets and tried to clean up the crime scene with towels, then grabbed knives, gloves, and bloody towels and left Craig Chandler Price, who was charged with 6 counts for a juvenile delinquency by reason of first-degree murder and 2 of the delinquency by reason of burglary. And though he looked good for getting life, there was a problem. Rhode Island law in 1989 didn't allow the state to hold minors past their 21st birthday, no matter what crime. And Craig was just shy of 16. He would be released from the Youth Correctional Center in 6 years tops, and his records would be sealed. "When I get out, I'm gonna smoke a bomber," Price yelled to the crowd as he was led, handcuffed, from the courthouse. On September 21st, 1989, Craig pled guilty to charges for murder and burglary in addition to serving time at correctional center. He would also undergo intense psychological examination and therapy. Or at least he would have if he hadn't continuously refused the treatment and dismissed discussing the case by pleading the fifth. Instead, inside the center, he completed his high school equivalency test and began taking satellite college courses by 1993. He was a star juvenile and got special treatment by counseling other youths performing light security duties. It was allowed to make a rap video including threatening lyrics. This angered the victim's family and special treatment ended. On the outside, there was a small army doing everything in their power to keep Craig in jail. There was something fundamentally wrong with the system that allowed someone who killed 4 people to simply go free at 21. Then Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Pine said in 1990, Pine and Detective Kevin Collins instigated the passing of O'Neill Bill with harsh sentences on teenage murders. But this wasn't enough. When Pine was elected Attorney in General in 1992, he pushed what is known as the Craig Price Bill, which allowed judges to consider the criminal records in deciding whether someone should be committed to a psychiatric hospital. It was passed in 1994. Wesley, prophet of Massachusetts psychiatrists who examined Price on behalf of the state, wrote in 1990 that Price was a serial killer who was in a psychotic rage at the time of murders. He is in dire need of extensive treatment, Prophet continued, and even then may not be in a position to be safely placed in the community. The year prior, 1993, Pines, Collins, Jones' mother, Murray, and sister Mary Lou created Citizens, opposed the release of Craig Price or Corp. The organization's main focus was raising public awareness to Craig's crimes and passing legislation that would prevent his release. Even with new legislation, Craig still refused a court order to undergo further psychological testing. This allowed Pine to file contempt of court charges and later extortion with Craig. Threatened a corrections officer's life, Craig's new lawyer Robert Mann accused Attorney General's office of twisting the laws to specifically target his client. Maybe that was true, which is a few days before Craig's 21st birthday, he was sentenced to 15 years. That wasn't enough, and the charges kept coming. Between fights in prison and somehow violating his probation while still in prison, the state of Rhode Island was found creative ways to keep Craig Price in prison. Craig has tried to appeal his convictions. Writing to journalist Mark Arsenault, he says, "I am being provoked beyond all endurable standards. All these people are fascinated with raw violence, and I am absolutely sure these drama freaks are trying their hardest to coerce me into unrestrained demonstration of brutality." As Craig puts it, the state wants him to harm others to the point where he gets life for some time. Craig Price did have hope of getting out of the prison over the decades. That hope has diminished, and the belief of the state want him to one day get life in prison seemed to become reality. In July 2009, armed with shank, Craig injured one of the correctional officers around 7:25 a.m. Craig got into a fight with another inmate. Two guards broke it up. Suffering injuries, Craig was transferred in 2004 from Rhode Island prison to Florida One, and has since been booked twice for fighting in 2007. He allegedly attacked an inmate with weapon created from razor blade and paperclip. He was once again transferred. His location remains unknown. Despite these charges, Craig has managed to shave off 1,519 days or 4 years from his sentence due to good time.
More shocking, we discovered Price was never docked any of that good time when he stabbed a Florida correctional officer in the hand with a homemade weapon during a scuffle with another inmate in 2009. What do you say to them? When Target 12 first brought our findings to Rhode Island prison officials, we were told Florida never asked to have Price's good time impacted.
If we are going to send an inmate to another state because that inmate is problematic, then we rely on that state's professional judgment.
But records show otherwise. This court document obtained by Target 12 clearly spells out Florida recommended Price lose a year's worth of good time as punishment. In the wake of Target 12's report, the Department of Corrections launched a review of Price's sentence. In a statement, a prison spokesperson now says they reviewed the good behavior statute and Price had a total of 40 days added back onto his sentence term. Why only 40 days? Prison officials say by law they can only take away good time he's already earned. It's complicated, but Price is serving a patchwork of sentences, not for the murders, but for various crimes he committed while behind bars. At the time of the 2009 prison stabbing, Price had just started serving a 7-year sentence for criminal contempt, according to prison officials. So they say he hadn't earned a lot of good time for that sentence. So when does he get out? As of now, he could taste freedom in the spring of 2021, according to the Department of Corrections.
That investigation was launched in 2015. From my understanding, by Rhode Island law, an inmate can earn up to 10 days off of their sentence for every month of good behavior. Legally, that inmate can collect 1 day of good time per month for every year they have been sentenced to prison. Even with his good time, Price now faces an attempted murder charge.
It was April 2017 when inmate Joshua Davis says he was in his cell at the Sewanee Correctional Institution when Craig Price snapped.
He attacked me and then he chased me out after I got out, attacked me again in the day room, and it took two officers and two inmates to pull him off.
Investigators say Davis was in bad shape when he was rushed to a local hospital. Price is accused of using a 5-inch homemade knife.
In the chest, in the head, twice in the back, twice on this side, in the spine, on the neck, and then lower on the spine also.
Price has pled not guilty to the charges. His court date has been delayed 4 times, at the latest date being September 24, 2018. He faces 1 count of attempted murder and 1 count of contraband in prison. Joshua told Target 12 that he had no idea why he was attacked and said he fears for other lives. If Price is ever released from prison, Joshua's attack was caught on video. According to court documents, Craig's sentence was set to expire. An additional 2 years, 6 months, and 23 days were added for stabbing of Florida correctional officer. Craig, now 44, was set to be released in 2020, but remained in prison until the trial is completed. Carl Betty stated, "At 13, he killed my sister, and at 15, he butchered an entire family. I don't believe any time in prison is going to stop him from doing it again once he's released." Well, now that was a heavy case. No monster like Craig Price should ever let to be roam free. But if I meet there, I do feel that this case raises many questions as a whole. Not a criminal case, it often makes us feel wonder that this extraordinary steps taken to keep Price in prison was because of the racial inequality which was majorly seen. Now, I do not want to come across as a supporter, but let's be frank. Equality, irrespective of human's color, has to be served. While I do applaud the state and other departments, I would want to see similar judgment being applied to the recent 17-year-old Kenosha shooter who shot 2 unsuspecting protesters at Jacob Blake rally, who was later seen walking freely with his rifle. This racial injustice has to be stopped. And as a personal opinion, it's high time that we treat minors for their crimes rather than their age, as exposure to the media and its influence would beg to look and differ of how a juvenile of wild crimes has to be treated. Thank you for tuning into Crime with K. Times like this test humans' emotional limits. So, be nice to everyone. We do not know what kind of war they are waging inside. And more importantly, we do not want to be the reason to create a monster. Stay safe and always remember to listen Crime with K podcast, but not to pop up as the next episode on my podcast.